Testing 1, 2, 3. All right. I'm not blowing anything out.
Ignorant weasels chewing on your soul. Ignorant weasels. Do you have speed?
Yeah.
This is AVXL episode 13, recorded April 21st, 2016. From deep in the heart of the Iron Triangle in Richmond, California, welcome to AVXL, your guide to the best in home theater gear and content, no matter what your budget is. I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, and I'm Robert Herron.
And we are excited. Game of Thrones season 6 is coming Sunday night. Are you going to watch it?
It's HBO, right?
Yeah.
Something I do not have. Although, it's probably in the house somewhere. I could find it. But I have not even looked at any of that content yet. So I'm waiting for a binge session at some point in the near future where I can get caught up on that epic show.
Come to my house.
I'm knee deep in Archer, baby. Season 7, I think it is now.
Oh, my goodness.
So my animated fix. And lots of quality movie catch-up time, too. There, all of the cool sci-fi movies over the summer, mm-hmm. or over the year so far, I haven't seen any of them. So
ooh.
I'm just going to start picking those off, I think.
Have you seen The Martian yet?
Okay, one I've seen. Okay. That's the only movie I've seen. So.
The only movie he's seen.
And I actually have that on ultra high def Blu-ray.
You do.
And I also have Mad Max on ultra high def Blu-ray. So
it'll have more pixels.
It will.
Do you have access to an HDR ready TV right now?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm staring at one.
Oh, the Samsung.
Yeah, a couple of them.
Okay. That makes me feel better.
And there will be more.
Because we mock the extra pixels and we desire the HDR. And if you're not sure what we're talking about, you should probably check out episode 12 of AVXL, and you can find that at avxl.com. Oh my goodness. A bunch of stuff to talk about. This episode coming hot on the heels of the double recorded episode 12. The new laptop, Robert's new laptop, behaving admirably. We're excited about that.
I'm pleased.
You were noticing that Comcast is going boxless for some customers.
Yeah, I was going through the news today, and up on USA Today, they had an article about how Comcast is allowing customers in certain markets to use a new app service they're offering.
Nice.
So ditch the cable box. Internet only required, and then this basically provides you with a Comcast Xfinity app, mm-hmm. that provides all of the channels you would like in terms of live TV viewing and other services like that. Cloud-based DVR and other functionality as well. So effectively doing something that I think the FCC would like to encourage everyone to eventually offer for the satellite and cable folks is to provide a boxless way of enjoying that content, or a way to have, you know, the security aspect of what locks that box down to your account and things like that. Do it in software, so right. I don't need another set-top box sitting in the living room. And I'm all for that. And I think the other good thing here is that, well, kind of a good and bad. Apparently, though, if you don't have Comcast's internet service, it will require, you're using someone else's internet service per
right.
se, it will require a small hardware box in order to become compatible.
Interesting.
However, they're going to provide that little box for free. So if you're looking to continue to be a cord cutter, but you'd still like to enjoy, you know, arguably one of the bigger cable providers out there, and with Comcast, Universal, NBC, mm-hmm. all conglomerated as such, I think it's a pretty good thing. And any way for folks to not have to get locked into a 2-year contract
right.
for often substandard hardware and things like that, a simplified experience with an app built into the TV, or in this case, they also talked of using, I think, Roku 3 and 4s to be able to provide the app service as well. So you may already have everything you need to enjoy a yet another taste of live TV programming from another quality source. I just to throw it in there real quick too, I'm hearing lots of great things about PlayStation's Vue, their TV service, mm-hmm. and I think this is just a and you add that into what we saw last year with Sling TV, mm-hmm. and coming from the Dish folks, and I've never seen more good live options currently right. going. Hopefully we'll start to see some 4K live options here soon, be it through broadcast or through streaming. And with those other announcements too from companies like New Lion and their demos for providing Samsung and Sony 4K TVs with live sports programming in 4K, I this should be a pretty good year, I think, for just alternative options for getting content you want. As particularly live stuff,
mm-hmm.
Especially if you don't live near an environment where there's a lot of over-the-air broadcasts where you could receive free channel tuning that way.
Right.
A lot of people don't, or they just don't have the ability to put up the antenna or to deal with it. And I think the apps are a terrific way to go. And I like to see...
Or the only way to go.
Yeah. And I'm also just happy to see that this is one of the things the FCC is actually focused on. And the current administration has actually mentioned they would like to see it go this way too, in terms of being able to receive that content without hardware or without having a set-top box.
When you look at the part of the motivation for this is for the FCC or Obama or whoever's behind this, is that you're looking at people being locked in. You know, we have all these hardware options, we have all these set-top boxes, we have all these applications on TVs, and I can understand if I were Comcast, I have some sympathy. Having worked, when I was back at Revision 3, we started making applications, right? Because people wanted applications to run on their Android phone, to run on their iPhone, on iOS, right? They wanted an application that would allow us to play their video. But there was also specific applications for Sony televisions, Samsung televisions, LG televisions. There were televisions that used this sort of Yahoo operating system for several weeks. And you start piling these up. Oh, by the way, there's also, for example, now a different Apple TV application if you want to be on tvOS. And of course, there's Roku. You start getting into this gigantic laundry bag of options that need to be developed for, many of which people will never, ever find your application. So it's kind of a waste of development effort, which means it's a waste of money, which is frustrating. So I have some sympathy for, and this may be the only time you ever hear me say this, I have some sympathy for the cable companies in that situation. The flip side is that you're talking about, something like 20, the quote I saw was something ridiculous like $20 billion a year in cable box revenue.
Oh, yes.
Cable box rental revenue.
I want to say there's probably another zero close to being added to that. It's probably pushing $100+ million, the last numbers I saw. Also,
I said billion.
Oh, billion.
Billion.
Oh, that's a mighty big dollar.
That's a lot of money.
One of the cool things, though, I mentioned the FCC in particular, but the current chairman, Tom Wheeler, that's one of the best Twitter accounts I think you can follow in terms of just getting good, insightful commentary about the current state of what these issues are and what are the proposed solutions and things like that. And
right.
He may be the chairman of the FCC, but he seems as much of a user as anyone could have ever asked for to be in that position, in terms of an enthusiast user,
right.
Where, here his thoughts in terms of how things should be seem to align pretty well with I think, a lot of people, what they would like to see, subscription TV programs become and the... removing the locks between having hardware tied to that service and using something you already own that's built into your TV. So a lot of good ideas coming out there. And like I said, too, if you can follow Tom Wheeler FCC on Twitter,
all right.
I recommend it. It's a good insights, and he's always keeping me abreast of what's coming up.
It's always interesting to see what the FCC is working on, especially since it directly impacts so much of what we enjoy, like the internet.
And it's a lot of TV stuff, too. I'm always interested
television.
In. Like the new broadcast standard for over-the-air, ATSC3, right. is something else I'm paying attention to very closely, and he occasionally throws out a good tidbit about that.
Are we going to have one standard, or are we going to have 22 slightly diverging specs based on the manipulation and lobbying of all of the consumer electronics industry members?
It will coalesce to one standard. And the cool thing, without getting too much into the weeds, with for ATSC3, anyone who cares, I think the biggest change you're going to notice is that it's a switch to an IP-based system, IP packetized video.
You mean it could go over the internet?
It could. And it could also, it is incredibly expandable at that point. It doesn't have to be just video, or
right.
it can be data services in addition to, it makes it more future-proof. And in
That's
addition
cool.
to supporting 4K, high dynamic range, wide color gamut support, that is all there too. But I think it's long overdue that our digital TV system finally becomes a packetized video system where then it plays nicer with our networked devices.
Digital in the sense of the word. Oh my goodness. I am a huge fan of Shoe subwoofers. Dr. Shoe basically got out of college and has spent the last 20 something years or so making some of the finest low-end speakers on the planet. The
You've been praising them for 15 plus years, I think. Now.
Well, it's hard to find something better for the money.
Gotcha.
I mean, maybe I need to hear some more SVS and Velodyne and some of the other stuff. But in any case, I'm actually looking forward to hearing ELAC's new subwoofer, which does some tuning based on a phone application. We'll get to look at that with the ELAC speakers. Talk about that later. But sweet. I bring that up because the entry level, I've bought a couple of shoe subwoofers off of Craigslist or eBay, and the entry-level shoe subwoofer, the SDF-2, starts at around $359, which is not bad considering it hangs in there with a lot of $1,000 subwoofers. It's sold direct. You're not going to find one in your local store. Great roundup on the Wirecutter by Brent Butterworth, the best, and the audio, the SoCal audio testing team at the Wirecutter. I think I know some of those people who might have been there. The best budget subwoofer. And he says, if anyone asks me what's the best affordable way to add bass to a small stereo, home theater, or computer sound system, I tell them to buy a Monoprice 9723 subwoofer. The 9723 Emerge is the clear favorite after 20 hours of testing by our Southern California base of audio experts, including extensive blind comparisons with 10 other subwoofers priced below $300. Priced at just a little over $100 plus shipping at the time of writing, the Monoprice 9723 is also an incredible bargain. It delivers powerful, well-defined bass notes that can shake your couch a little and help make movies and music sound more satisfying and realistic. Put on a Kanye West recording and you'll feel much of that colossal thump you hear with a high-end custom-installed sound system. Put on a Diana Krall CD and you'll clearly hear the subtle growl and groove of her band's big double bass. That is high praise. I've known Mr. Butterworth for a very long time. He knows more about audio than you do, I assure you. And if you know more than audio than he does, you're one of about eight people out there.
He's a humble gentleman, too.
He is good people.
But talking audio with that guy is always a blast.
Yeah, there is no way to come out of a conversation with him without learning something. But it's a really good roundup. They talk about, connecting a subwoofer, where to put a subwoofer, adjusting a subwoofer. And that's a big deal, figuring out the crossover levels. And can learn correctly configuring it. Let's see.
That's something we should probably get into. I mean, the automatic tools are always fun to use.
Sure.
But there's a lot you can do just by listening with the right test tone.
We can talk about crossovers configuration and what to do when you don't have a subwoofer out on your. Well, I was laughing because I'd been using an AVR for so long. Then I started getting hot and heavy on my great audiophile audio adventure this fall. And I was laughing my ass off because I'm not running a preamp. I'm running a source directly into a power amplifier. And then you run into the situation like, how am I going to get the audio into my subwoofer, or am I going to use the pass-through on the subwoofer, which actually is not most subwoofers do a pretty good job. But really good article on the Wirecutter. We'll put a link to that in the show notes.
$108 bucks, though, for that sub.
Yeah.
Is their pick. Yeah. That's a bargain.
The next runner-up is the BIC America V1020, which is $164. They basically said it was a little pricier and more difficult to connect, but solid bass. And, of course, the Andrew Jones designed Pioneer SW8MK2, which is a little bit smaller and a little more refined, which means it's a little less, and a little more detail and sensitivity.
I thought that Monoprice actually borrowed some of the Andrew Jones design characters. Well, the curving sides
we'll talk about Monoprice later, but it is a fantastic deal. And if you can help out the Wirecutter by using the links off of the Wirecutter's website, because they make their revenue by the affiliate sales off of Amazon and other sites. So do them a favor and take care of them, because the people doing work there are doing fantastic work and they're working their butts off for you. We got a tweet last week from Chris at Ace OD about affordable gear for the person looking to calibrate a display system for optimal color. And, this is not just for HDTVs, but this will also work for your computer monitor.
Yes.
At some point, I really want to calibrate my laptop monitor, but I don't want to go down that rat hole right now. What do you recommend, Robert, for somebody who wants to, what do we even call the tool, the box we strap to the monitor that sucks down the light from the pixels?
You could call it just a color meter, mm-hmm. or if you want to get more technical, there's a couple different kinds, a spectroradiometer and a spectrophotometer. Generally, the photometers are the ones where you're using a filter, mm-hmm. a filtered eye, effectively, that then takes the incoming light, separates it out into detecting the red, the blue, and the green portion of it. these are what they call tri-stimulus devices, where you're basically measuring how red, blue, and green are mixing, because just about every display you'll ever look at, if you look at it with a magnifying glass up close, you'll see that each pixel is a red, a blue, and a green pixel that are combined together to then you modulate those three particular colors into whatever color you need, or black being mm-hmm. off, or pure white being all on. And X-Rite is one of my favorite companies. I believe they're based out of, I want to say, a Swiss company. But anyway, X-Rite's i1 Display Pro. It's $250 currently. It is a monitor calibration tool, and the reason I'll hold this one up above anything that costs less is, at least I'm not aware of anything else in this price range that will let you do two specific things, especially going forward with 4K.
Mm-hmm.
One is the wide color gamut support. You need a meter that can actually be compatible with color palettes larger than just standard HD video.
Right.
That HD video spec for color actually is super similar to the original PC color spec as well. They're actually modeled very similarly. And the i1 Display Pro also supports brightness levels up to 1,000 nits, which there are some TVs that will exceed that, but generally every TV out there is going to fall within that category. So you've got not only the color accuracy, but the ability to handle the bright light output of a particular display. There is terrific free software out there. If you really want to dive into it, HCFR, you can look that up. I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. But that's been a project going around the AVS forums for a long time. And it is a good piece of software that is compatible with a wide variety of different color tools, be it X-Rites or others. I think that is the best way to do it. Honestly, if you're just getting started, take a look at the calibrated presets on a TV always. I mean, start there and get a feel for what the manufacturer did mm-hmm. as far as the settings go related to that calibrated cinema or movie mode on the TV. You'll notice that a lot of what may look like cool features get turned mm-hmm. off in terms of image enhancement and other things like that actually are just adding fake information to the picture. So I think it's good to not only take a look at those presets and get a good understanding for the decisions they made for those calibrated presets versus the not, but then when it comes to tools, something like the X-Rite i1 Display Pro, even just out of the box, you'll be able to do your color calibrations for computer displays and things like that. Ideally, you won't even be doing a calibration. You'll just be creating not a lookup table for the notebook, but creating a color profile that's tied directly into the OS. So no matter what else you're doing, that calibrated color profile loads automatically for you. And that might be my favorite thing, and I do that with every notebook I get a hold of. I'll create that color profile once, custom to my notebook, and then that just saves it as a single file then that gets loaded in the OS as it boots up. But when it comes to adjusting TVs and other things like that,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure the software it comes with could provide you with the basic information in terms of like what are the color coordinates for this particular shade of gray or color that I'm measuring.
Right.
But you know, sometimes that is like, wow, okay, I'm getting these XY coordinates, is this where it should be or not? And that's where I would say go to a piece of software like HCFR that basically can provide you with a graphical interface that lets you then better visualize what it is you're doing. And it provides a lot of automated presets, not presets per se, but just tools you can use to run through some basic measurements. Like, show me what the grayscale looks like from black to pure white. And
right.
is it consistent? And, oh, check my max saturated color coordinates. Are they at least in the ballpark? I mean, or is my gamut large enough to support the video content I'm looking at? And these tools will just allow you to, you know, get it done in quick order. And I like the fact, especially with X-Rite, it's a good multi-purpose tool as well. This is something you could take over to a friend's house and use it on their TV. This is something you could, like I said, calibrate your computer, your notebook, and what have you, in addition to working on display systems as well. And it's also, I think, just the quality of the hardware.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, having that bright light support, the 1,000 nits, so to speak, and the wide color gamut are two things you're not going to find on more affordable options out there right now. And besides that, my personal experience with X-Rite has been just a fantastic hardware company over the years in terms of just good prices for what you pay or what you're looking for. I mean, they have expensive meters too, but I think that $250 price point for the i1 Display Pro is a good starting point for a lot of people.
And it's going to last you a very, very long time.
Yeah. I mean, you always want to take care of any filter, any filter-based photometer. I'm always a little more concerned about over the long term. Like after a year or two, I would definitely like to get it recertified. But, you know, I haven't actually messed with the i1 Display Pro all that much to see how well it holds up over time. Right. I have a different X-Rite product that is effectively sealed. And actually, I have a couple of them. And those, I find, instead of using filters, the particular meter I'm using often for doing calibration setup is specifically a photon counter. It just says, okay, I have sensors for red, blue, and green, and I'm just detecting the particles of light as they go flying by. And it's not even using a filter system. It's saying it's doing basically a color match function based upon the number of photons it counts for red and blue green stimulus.
That's pretty crazy.
So that's you know, it's getting a little out there, but
at least it's consistent.
Short answer, X-Rite's i1 Display Pro, $250. I'm just saying it's available now. Actually, $248.
Oh, my goodness. If you've got a question, do us a favor. Email ask@avxl.com or tweet @avxl or @Robert Heron or @Patrick Norton. We'll do our best to answer it in the show or in email or on the Twitters. And we want to remind you that AVXL is made possible by your support. If we're helping make your home theater and entertainment more amazing, do us a favor. Head on over to patreon.com/AVXL and support the show. It's cheap. And if we get enough of you working together, a dollar here, a dollar there, we can start doing video and we can keep doing the show each and every week for you. It was funny. I was trying to find a different link on the internets and found a link that says HBO Now is heading to consoles with Xbox One and Xbox 360 apps and some Samsung smart TVs too. So Robert, you're closer. If you're just willing to spend the money, you can have HBO Now and watch all the Game of Thrones.
True. I could just go HBO Now. Because what is it? HBO Go is for if you already your subscriber. Yeah.
HBO Now is the HBO Now is what I'm using, which is the online subscription.
I could probably borrow an account.
Oh, boy, I'm getting started on that.
I'm getting caught up.
APOXNA, the Audio Expo North America, was last week. I bring that up because I was talking to a friend of mine who works for a audio company who shall remain nameless. He said it was interesting because last year all the super expensive stuff was super popular. So essentially, right, this is a place where you go to see all of the incredible, expensive, amazing $1 billion stereo systems.
Oh, like a high-end audio show.
Yeah, it's a high-end audio show. And a bunch of other stuff. It's the kind of stuff that gets picked, it gets written about in Stereophile magazine and stuff. One of the reactions I heard from that was that the incredibly expensive stuff was not so popular this year.
Hmm.
And that the less expensive stuff, for example, ELAC, the speaker company that Andrew Jones is designing for that I have been raving about and will finally get to hear about 10 days from now, the final version of those the new speakers, the Unify speakers, those are actually shipping April 30th.
Awesome.
But Stereophile, as always, has a pretty good summary of stuff. But yeah, it's amazing when you're looking at, you know, and I'm going to read this in my head one more time. Oh, yes, the 50th anniversary Technics SL1200 GAE turntable that's selling for $4,000, which to some minds is actually a reasonable price for a turntable.
It's gorgeous.
Yeah. Their network audio amplifier for $4,000. Thorin. It's interesting stuff. A $1,500 ultrasonic audio desk. The $1,500 vinyl cleaner, which is much more reasonable than the $3,800 vinyl cleaner. And it's an interesting question when you're looking at some of this high-end audio. At what point are the people who's buying this stuff dying off, and or are people just realizing that this individual pursuit, is just over the top and a bit too much? But I mean, the Stereophile article I'm looking at from Herb Reichert over at Stereophile, decades of experience have made Wilson Demos the big event, and this year's version presented by dealer Paragon Sight and Sound may have been the best ever. They introduced the new Wilson Alix speaker, $109,000 a pair. Was it amazing? Of course it was. It was powered by a range of Doshi Audio Tube electronics, which appeared to do their jobs in some newer, higher level than I am used to. You know, it's, you know, when you hear some of this stuff, I will say some of this stuff sounds extraordinary.
Yes.
You know, and I'm not going to argue that. Like a set of Wilson, you know, like Watt Puppy speakers, which are like a more, I don't know, maybe they're $55,000. They're far more than I'm ever going to spend for a car, much less a pair of speakers.
I find when you get into this, you know, more than $10,000 a pair or, you know, up to $100,000+ a pair, it's almost as much as art as it is science.
Yes.
And the presence of the damn speaker is as much of it as anything. Being able to look at this crafted, crazy design.
Well, I was gonna say, you're not saying art like you have somebody who is because there's a point, right, where certain engineers, I remember my stepfather, they had this one guy at the chemical company. He basically was managing, you know, personnel at the chemical company, and this one guy that they had to hold on to because he could make weird gas mixtures that they couldn't find anybody else to make the gases blend, right? So at some point you can have science slash engineering that is in that, like, You know, Leonardo, he did a thing with a brush and the colors, and it's exquisite.
Job security.
Yeah, it's really hard to create the Mona Lisa even now, and we got technology, right? which reminds me of a great documentary, but I can't remember the name of it, but we'll talk about that later.
Mystery of the World Part 1.
No, but that is a really great documentary. But, you know, you hear this stuff, it's extraordinary. And like Robert's pointing out, the presentation is exquisite, right? Where you're looking at something that has all of the excellence of fine furniture. You know, where it gets interesting, though, is can I get 90% of the way there for 90% less money?
Yes.
And that's, often, you know, yeah, a lot of this high end stuff, yes, is super, super fragmented. You know, so, and, you know, a friend of mine from Emotiva was there, and he said, you know, we had a ton of traffic, and Emotiva makes a lot of relatively inexpensive stuff, right? There, a lot of people haven't maybe heard of them outside of the audio community. But if you're looking for a pretty badass amplifier, or a digital analog converter / headphone amp, I've got one of their little Legos coming in for testing. I heard one at CanJam that sounded fantastic. You know, and that's like $160.
Totally. I mean, it's all relative to budgetary concerns too.
I mean, you
think about what $100,000 speaker, you know, what that budget would allow for
right,
a regular person's home.
Oh, yeah, a house.
Or buying a home, you know, that, there's that level. And then it's like, okay, I've got all of that. And now it's like, I want to step this up to not only the craziest room design,
right,
but something worthy of,
right,
you know, and I'm not necessarily putting a value on just the pure price alone, but some of these speakers in that level are just, I think they're just, they look fantastic,
right,
even when they're not playing a damn note. And the designs are incredible. Granted, it is a lot of money. And,
yeah. Well, for $100,000, I want a transcendent experience that feels that as if I am there. And one of the unfortunate things that I've been playing with for the last few months as I've been on my audio geeking adventure at a significantly lower price tag, I might add, is, you know, one of the problems is once you get to a certain level of fidelity and excellence in audio reproduction from your DAC through your amplifier, through your speakers, your headphones, is that, you know, you're going to realize that some of your favorite recordings were maybe not recorded so well. Like one of my favorite tracks to listen to is Count Basie, Frank Sinatra, Fly Me to the Moon.
Oh, right? Yeah.
Fantastic track. There was a lot of love. There's a couple spots where the orchestra crescendos and it blows stuff out, but there was a lot of love in that recording. And then sometimes I'll turn around and I'll listen to something and I'll realize that, yeah, they threw a mic in a room and threw another mic over there, and, you know, I'm pretty sure somebody's foot was hitting the mic,
yeah,
stand. And it's part of the song, it's part of what was recorded, but there's a level of excellence in the capture there that's not so good. And this applies to, like, you know, the first two or three Blu-rays we saw back in 1,000 years ago, where there was like obvious dust and scratches, and not, you know, one of the prints looked fake. Like they used a print, not a negative, but a print to,
yep,
actually capture the source material.
A few years back, I was at a high-end audio exhibition, probably at CES. I was up in the tower or whatever, or wherever the hell they were doing high-end audio at that moment. But it was one of those rooms where these pair of speakers, very expensive, $15,000, some crazy turntable. But then they had like an original Louis Armstrong record. I mean, it was like the original. And they put that on, and
there's a lot of audio in that.
In a pure analog environment where it was like, I don't think there was any really digital anything going on in this room. It was just strictly, though, having that original pressed record, and there was just a sense of
reverence.
It sounded good. It sounded amazing. Mm-hmm. But there was also just like, this is probably how it was like the week it came out mm-hmm. in terms of, well, it probably sounded better than.
Probably a lot better, actually. Yeah, I've heard a lot of vintage speakers over the last few years. My next door neighbor collects vintage speakers.
But that was something where I truly was like, wow, this is just sonically. And then if you opened your eyes and looked around the room, it's like, wow, this is impressive to look at, impressive to hear. But again, it's just like I'm more into the the Audio Technica's ATLP 120 USB turntable for $250, which my roommate just picked up actually, and he's loving that thing actually. Well, I'm done with vinyl personally, but I do appreciate the experience.
I was done with vinyl about 5 minutes after CDs came out, except for the short list of albums that have never made the transition from, like, for example, there's a New York Citizens album or a Donkey Show album, and these are like obscure 1980s ska bands that you know, it's taken me umpteen years to find those albums so I can digitize them and listen to them anywhere else. Something to look out for later this year if you're into bargain audio is Emotiva is going to release the next generation of their Mini-X A100 amplifier that should sell for around $200. I cannot wait to get my grubby little ears on that.
Is that a monoblock or is that a...
No, that's a very, very small stereo amplifier.
Oh, sweet.
So it's good. You know, ATI is another company a lot of people don't know about. Jeff Morrison turned me on to these guys. They make their amplifiers in basically like LA and like Hollywood. One of the most exquisite, the build construction on this is like looking at NASA's, you know, wiring guidelines. If you've ever stumbled across those on the webs, one of my I should tweet those out because, you know, this amplifier, the build quality, I mean, the person who sold it to me wrapped it on eBay, wrapped it in a piece of cardboard and put a label on it.
Oh, that box.
That's the one where the RCA jacks were half shoved in the back and the corners were dented. Everything held in the interior, like the build construction on that, it's like Baja 1000.
No, they didn't put any padding or anything. No. Literally, the cardboard is wrapped around the outside of the amp. And the ports were punching through the cardboard. Yeah. And it took a ding on the side, and this thing is still like in
perfect
99%.
Yeah, I mean, there's like you can see a couple dents on the corners, and I found the nuts, and I screwed the RCA jacks back out where they're supposed to be, but the thing's flawless. And you know, maybe they were pissed because it sold for $225, and they sell for like $700 new, but I'm pretty sure it was a pawn shop, and I'm pretty sure they did all right. But the
if it ever fails as an amp, it would make a good wheel block for holding a vehicle in place. Or
if it ever fails as an amp, I'm sending it back to ATI to get repaired. Because for the money, it's amazing. Okay.
That's
right?
The other and they nice thing I like to see, too, is that companies actually support their stuff for the long term when you invest in it.
I mean, you know, it's funny because, like I said, Jeff Morrison turned me on to them. They make a lot of the amps that are made in North America are made by ATI, and because their build quality is excellent, their designs are excellent. It sounds amazing. All of this I bring up, like I said, I'm about 10 days out from getting ears on the shipping version of ELAC Unify UB5 speakers. You know, the ELAC debuts have been shipping for a year. Incredibly popular if you don't want to spend a lot of money on a pair of speakers. I think their wire cutters kind of like best, you know, bookshelf speaker for most people. I'd love to hear them compared to Aperion Audio's Intimus, which is kind of, they're about $1,600 for a full surround sound set. They're very, very popular. If you don't have a lot of money to spend for home theater speakers, and we've heard...
For a 5.1 kit, $1,600?
Yeah.
That's not a huge
amount
of money. That's in the
realm of doability. Yeah, it's not the cheapest speaker. If you have no money, the Andrew Jones design Pioneer SP PK S22BS, the 5.1 home theater speakers package, that's still under $500. Sounds amazing for the money. Energy's classic Take 5 is still a phenomenal deal.
I have some of those in storage if you know anyone.
$320. Maybe we can put them here in the warehouse and start doing movie nights.
A buddy of mine, though, bought the Andrew Jones design, the Pioneer speakers, though. And
they're amazing.
Look and they sound great. That center channel is pretty big, so just to warn you.
Well, yeah.
Have appropriate room.
Have some space. The Energy Classic Take 5. Monoprice basically clones the Energy Take 5. And their version sells for under $200. They could sell them for about $180 right now. A little bit more bass than the Energy Classic Take 5. And I've heard from people that have heard them that the voices punch a bit more. You know, I bring all of this up because it's interesting. All of these speaker designs are all classic box designs. right? You have a box. There's reinforcing inside the box to minimize the amount of audio that's radiating out the back, because in a lot of speaker designs, almost as much audio comes out through the box of the speaker than actually comes out through the front of the speaker through the cone, which is not a positive thing because it does interesting things. And you know, when you start getting into sort of head transfer functions and looking at the ways we hear things, which is something I've been thinking a lot about lately, between CanJam and hearing the Osic headphones, and as part of my great audio adventure for the last few months, I got a chance to hear Linkwitz Labs LX Mini and LX Mini Plus 2 this weekend. Mr. Linkwitz and his lovely wife actually every so often invite people to come and listen to his speaker designs. This is a guy who's, you know, he was an HP engineer and a very serious kind of building test equipment stuff for years, and then got into designing speakers, and in the last few years has been working with open baffle speakers and creating basically designs that you can build yourself out of kits. And when you go to the Linkwitz Lab website, there's this jolly looking guy pulling his glasses down in the corner. That's Mr. Linkwitz. And I think he's Mr. Linkwitz and not Dr. Linkwitz. If he's Dr. Linkwitz, I'll be really embarrassed because he's an incredibly nice human being. But when you're talking about like $400 worth of drivers and PVC pipe, and he chose PVC pipe because it's you know, like Schedule 40 PVC. It's incredibly inexpensive. And because it's a tube, it doesn't really flex when the audio goes through it. But the idea here is that, and the most extreme version of it, is the... you know, his goal here is to have incredibly realistic two-channel sound, and he finds that speaker boxes are kind of a pain in the ass for that.
These are uniquely designed
yeah.
audio reproducers.
Yeah, well, okay. I mean,
it's hard to even call it a speaker.
Well, and then
it is a speaker. But...
Well, let's call them transducers,
okay?
Because right? transducers turn electrical signals into the physical movement in the air that our ears pick up. Like the LX521.4 is kind of his. You know, he's done. He's basically explored all the avenues, all the channels, all the driver options, and those are his, you know, he's created these, like, you know, four-way loudspeakers. He's using DSPs rather than hardwired crossovers, right? Because he's not getting an audible difference, and they allow, you know, greater, basically, manipulation or configuration or changes. But I got to say, the imaging, the stereo imaging coming from the LX521.
Oh, you've heard these?
I got to hear them in his house, in his living room, with my own tracks. And I got to hear some tracks from a couple other people there to audition. So the 521s go pretty solid down to about 60 hertz, maybe a little lower, down to about 40 hertz. And it's, you know, they're bi-amped, so there's two tweeters. And if you look at it, there's the woofer, the smaller speaker, I want to say does up to about 750 hertz and is acts as an omni because it's facing up, so it radiates sound in 360 degrees. The tweeter is on an open, or the smaller drivers is open on a... has an open baffle facing to the rear. And the end result is that it is designed to play sound, you know, like I say, omnidirectionally, except for the super high-end...
tweeter.
It's a 700 hertz crossover, and everything above 700 hertz is going through the tweeter. And it gives you a huge sense of, like, that concept of the space or the imaging or, you know, where it's like, okay, the drummer's there, the singer's there. You know, one of the guests there had this crazy Roger Waters track, Roger Waters tracks, you may know that name from Pink Floyd, you know, where the audio first starts out way over to the left of the speaker and ends up way over to the right of the speaker and moves around, and it's like you're in the middle of a parlor trick. You know, I was listening to the Cowboy Junkies, which is one of my favorite bands, their first album, which was recorded in a church in Canada, and it's big, beautiful voicing. You know, you got to build them yourself, but they're $400, and I'd say they'd hang with just about any speaker going up to a lot more money. And he just also did the Mini Plus 2, which adds a pair of subwoofers, and they really kicked. Like, hearing Rage Against the Machine in this was really, really fun.
Do you have to supply your own PVC pipe?
You got to supply your own PVC pipe.
That's cool.
You buy the drivers from Mattisound. Mattisound will provide you with, like, the parts and the pre-cut wood pieces.
Yeah, I'm curious to see how changing, like, the length of the pipe would mess. Are you supposed to just stick with the plan?
I would probably stick with the plan.
Okay. Because it's such a unique-looking speaker system.
Yeah. And well, you know, it's a PVC tube with a speaker sticking up out of it and a toilet coupler holding the speaker in place. Let's be honest.
For the front designs, I mean, for front channels, though, they're almost perfect for, like, okay, if they are about that high and the columns themselves are relatively tapered, it gets the sound up where I need it next on the sides of the screen.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be... And that, in addition to just straight up stereo imaging for music listening.
Well, he does use them for movies and stuff. They were primarily designed for fantastic, audio quality. For people who are not quite ready to deal with the LX521s, which are his big quad subwoofer full range. His definitive final statement on loudspeaker design, unless somebody comes up with a new technology that he tries to integrate. But these sound pretty fantastic, and it's something to think about, because when we look at planar magnetics are a very different way of making audio in a headphone than traditional sort of transducers or speakers are. And most of our speaker designs are based on boxes, with drivers sitting in the front. And there are a whole different way of doing this and a whole different way of representing sound. And in this case, the idea is that, the placement of the speaker is going to, it's less about putting a box in a room and more about putting the sound in a room. It's an interesting thing. If you get a chance to listen to it at some point, please do so. I may buy a set of the drivers to build the kit a little later this summer. I got some house projects to finish up first, but
I have a pair of Sennheiser. They're either electrostatic or they're an older pair of headphones that somebody had given me, and they need some help. And I looked up on the Sennheiser website, and they effectively won, I think, just a flat rate of like $300 to $400 just to get them back and do them up. But they'd be worth it to have them fixed and working again. And they're kind of classic too. So I'm like, I think that's my short-term project for, as I was going through my storage room the other day, reorganizing and tearing things apart.
But take a look at the linkwitzlab.com website if you want to see some radically different ways of thinking about audio reproduction in your listening room. They sounded fantastic. I would want to get the LX Mini Plus 2, which is a subwoofer version, but we'll see how that goes.
I'm digging it.
I got to go do This Week in Computer Hardware, so we're going to bring this episode of AVXL to a close. Do us a favor. Email us, ask@avxl.com, tweet at AVXL, or tweet at Robert Herron or at Patrick Norton, because we want to hear your questions.
Yes, we do.
We want to thank each and every one of you that is supporting us on patreon.com/AVXL. You are awesome, and we encourage everyone else to join us.
Yes.
Anything exciting coming up on Herron Fidelity this week?
Herron Fidelity, I am itching to get that Riva S review done. I have my calibration mic set up today.
Ooh.
And I'm going to run some audio through it to see what the responses are for the Bluetooth speaker. I was so impressed by that Turbo X. This is just a little more compact, refined version of that. It won't have the uber boom of the Turbo, but it is, every time I listen to it, I love it. And I think it might be one of the best, just like desk mates for a mobile device. In terms of the variety of crap you can connect it to with Bluetooth and everything else and AptX, but also it has an awesome speakerphone built into it and other things like that. So, it does what you think a portable speaker should do.
I have a roundup coming up between the Bluetooth speaker from Kef, B&W, Riva, and one or two others.
I've got a ton of updates for the website coming up just for all of the travel I've been doing lately and... between the gear, I got a bunch of people wanting to look at my results for a recent Vizio P-Series calibration. I'm hoping to have an M-Series calibration here
also
as soon as possible. And then I got to start talking to the great folks at not only the big guys like Samsung and LG and Vizio and those guys, but I want to see if I can get a couple of sets in from TCL and other companies as well, or at least get updates in terms of what they're up to for their 4K HDR goodness coming out later this year.
Nice.
Yep.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening. I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, and I'm Robert Herron.
We'll see you next week on AVXL.